The Celts, or Celtic people, were comprised of a collection of Indo-European clans that can be identified by their cultural similarities, such as dance, music, and clothing, often with blue dye in a pattern called tartan, consisting of crisscrossed, horizontal, and vertical bands in multiple colors, forming simple or complex rectangular patterns. Their diet would include wild food such as mushrooms, berries, wild garlic, and apples. They would also eat spinach, onions, leeks, carrots, nuts, and various grains for bread and porridge. As for meat, they would hunt deer, foxes, beavers, wild boars and bears, as well as farm domesticated animals such as chickens, goats, sheep, pigs, and cattle. They would also fish for salmon, trout, and mackerel, and eat eggs from hens and honey from bees. And of course, their Celtic language, which is part of the Aryan linguistic family. The first mention of the Celts was made by the Greek authors around 500 BC, but the most valuable insights are provided by Roman authors who came into direct contact with them on their northern borders. While it's commonly believed that the Celts were a collection of tribes which originated in Central Europe, genetic sequencing has shown that they were actually comprised of several waves of migration into Europe by separate tribes that shared a similar culture, traditions, and religious beliefs. We don't actually know for certain what the Celts called themselves, as none of the classical texts refer to the people of Britain and Ireland by that designation. The name Celts is a modern term which is used to describe many tribes of people who lived during the Iron Age rather than one collective empire or nation. In 279 BC, the Celts were known to have looted Delphi, the sacred Greek site, as well as having had a meeting with Alexander the Great in 335 BC in the Balkans. Classical writers had recorded a large-scale migration of Celts soon after 400 BC from Central Europe into Northern Italy and Eastern Europe, with some early sources placing them inland around the headwaters of the Danube River. It's believed that the Celts arrived at the shores of Britain at approximately 1000 BC and lived there during the Iron Age and continuing into the post-Roman era, where today Wales is seen as a Celtic nation. But to trace their true earliest origins, we must turn to genetics and linguistics. Most scholars agree that the Celtic language derived from an earlier Proto-Indo-European or Aryan language that reached Western Europe from Central Asia between 6000 and 2000 BC. That said, there was little agreement on precisely how or when this occurred until the recent revolution in genomic sequencing. A number of Irish annals, of which the earliest was the Chronicle of Ireland, were compiled up to and shortly after the end of the 17th century. While Ireland has no clear origin story, the Book of Invasions describes many migrations of people, including the mythical Tuatha De Danann, regarded as a mystical, fairy-like people who supposedly inhabited Ireland prior to the arrival of the Celts. The Tuatha De Danann are credited with naming Ireland, sending three of their goddesses to meet with the incoming Celts, which at the time were not one unified people, but multiple tribes spread all over Europe, which shared a more ancient history together. The Tuatha De Danann were descendants of Danaus, who in Greek mythology was son of an Egyptian king driven out by his brother that fled with his 50 daughters and whose myth is the foundation legend of Argos, where he became king of one of the foremost Mycenaean cities of the Peloponnese. In Homer's Iliad, the Danaans commonly designate the Greek forces opposed to the Trojans. There's a theory that a segment of the Celts are descended from one of the 10 lost tribes of Israel, the tribe of Dan, pointing to parallels between Irish and Hebrew culture, such as the harp, one of the symbols of Ireland. Also, it plays a role in Jewish history as the musical instrument of King David. That brings us to another instrument which is thought to be native to Scotland, the bagpipe.
Scotland's national instrument, the bagpipe, carries a long and honorable history, stretching back to the beginnings of civilization as one of the oldest known musical instruments. But what do we know about the precise origins of the bagpipe? While the trumpet was the instrument of the Roman cavalry, the bagpipe was the instrument of the Roman infantry. Some have proposed that it was introduced by the Romans. Others suggest, however, that the Romans picked it up from Celtic tribes. Even the Roman Emperor Nero was said to have been a pipe player, and there could be little doubt that the bagpipes are somehow intimately related to marching armies, if not to warfare itself. By going back further and further into history, a plausible outline takes shape. The bagpipe is referenced in the Bible and was carved with animal musicians in the late 15th and early 16th century throughout Europe. The Oxford History of Music says that a sculpture of bagpipes has been found on a slab in Turkey, dated to 1000 BC, but it's been destroyed. Here's a photograph of it. So does that mean they're not Irish? What do you think? Ancient depiction that fascinated me the most, however, is this one, showing what appears to be a siege, with divers swimming underwater, using what look like bagpipes, animal skin bags filled with air. According to Homer, divers were involved in military operations during the Trojan Wars. They sabotaged enemy ships by boring holes in the hulls, or cutting anchor ropes. When we look at these 4,000-year-old Minoan depictions of dolphins, we notice something attached to their noses, like a harness. And one can imagine that if dolphins were used in sea battles, as has been suggested by some of the ancient myths, then having a bag for air would make sense. It's fun to speculate about ancient scuba divers, especially when the depictions are so clear and vivid. But there is, however, another practical use for the bagpipe that's not related to warfare, and that's the almost hypnotic sound produced, especially when in conjunction with drums or other percussion instruments that help to bring about a trance state one used by shamans to make contact with the gods, which can also be interpreted as entering into an altered state of consciousness, enabling the shaman to communicate with the collective subconscious mind, bringing back some needed information, or even allegedly divination about future events. When both of these uses for the bagpipe are taken into consideration, I would speculate that the bagpipe was introduced into Europe by marching armies, for sure, but I would also argue that the shaman types, like druids, probably already had similar, if not identical, instruments, not to attack a castle by swimming under the moat like a fish, but to soar in the sky like a bird, lifted up by the sweet hypnotic sounds of the sacred instrument, the bagpipe.
It's just a great instrument to play. It's just wonderful to play, sort of thing.
Oh, it's a fantastic feeling. It's great hearing the pipes and the drums. It's a real vibrant feel to it. It's superb.
Ireland's long history is riddled with folklore, ancient mythology, and ancient societies, which include the Druids, who were highly regarded among the Celts. They were considered teachers, wise priests, and even as magicians. Many stories and myths indicate that the Druids frequented oak forests a lot. Subsequently, the Celtic meaning of the word druid is knowing or finding the oak tree. Stories of fairies playing pranks on farmers and leprechauns hiding their gold at the end of a rainbow are other examples of legends preserved in Celtic society. They did not leave behind a written record. So, knowledge of the Druids comes from classical writers of their time, such as the Greeks and Romans, and they were compared to the Aryan Brahmins of India, the Pythagoreans of Greece, and the Chaldean astronomers of Babylon. Julius Caesar wrote that they, and I quote, "know much about the stars and celestial motions, and about the size of the earth and universe, and about the essential nature of things, and about the powers and authority of the immortal gods, and these things they teach to their pupils," end quote. That said, there is surprisingly very little that is known about the ancient origins of the Druids, at least as far as academia is concerned. Turning to legend, let us start with one concerning how Scotland got its name. Scota, in Irish mythology, is the name given, in this version of the tale, to the daughter of an Egyptian pharaoh around the time of the Exodus, who married someone named Goidel Glas and became the founder of the Scots and Gaels after being exiled from Egypt. Now, Goidel Glas was the grandson of a Scythian prince, one of 72 chieftains who allegedly built the Tower of Babel. Goidel Glas is credited with the creation of Gaelic, which is the Proto-Irish language, and it's from one of the original 72 languages that allegedly arose from the time of the confusion of tongues. The part in the Bible where God gets upset and destroys the tower and disperses the people, confusing their languages. I admit, these are fantastic stories,
but they seem to have been taken quite seriously by European royalty. The size of this stone is about 26 inches by 17 inches by 11 inches, and its weight is approximately 336 pounds. The top bears chisel marks, and there are rings at each end for easier transport. In appearance, insignificant, but to kings and queens, an irreplaceable artifact. It is called the Stone of Destiny, and it has been revered for centuries as a holy relic and fought over by the Scottish and English for some 700 years. The stone has been used successively by British and other monarchs as a very important part of their enthronement ceremonies. Legend has it that it was transported to Ireland via Spain by Princess Skada, also known as Princess Meritaten, who fled Egypt following the overthrow of her father. For those interested to go deeper down this rabbit hole, you can check out a book written in 1939 by none other than Sigmund Freud called Moses and Monotheism. The grave of Princess Skada allegedly lies in an Irish valley known as Glen Scoithin, or Vale of the Little Flower, indicated by a road signpost, and the trail from the road leads along a stream to a clearing where a circle of large stones marks the gravesite.
Well, there's our research that we're hearing today that shows half of all Western European men are somehow related to the Egyptian pharaoh, King Tutankhamun.
Not only do half of Western European men have this connection, genetic profile connection, but 70% of men in Britain, which is astounding, but they all have the same genetic profile or same ancestry as King Tut from Egypt way back when. And here's what's really shocking about this. Less than 1% of modern day Egyptians have that same connection. So you kind of makes you wonder, well, if he's Egyptian, but the ancestry isn't Egyptian, how did it evolve? Which way did it move? And it looks like it didn't start in Egypt, but it evolved and went to Egypt and may have started in Europe. And that's why all the Europeans have this background.
Isn't that interesting?
Red hair is the rarest natural hair color in humans, was thought to be the sign of a witch during the Middle Ages, and the distribution of red hair in the world population is about 1%. But in Scotland and Ireland, it's about 10 to 13% of the population that has red hair, with 30 to 45% unknowingly carriers of the red hair gene. This region is also particularly high in rhesus negative blood type, sharing this trait with the Basque, Berbers, and others in an interesting and important topic, which I will continue on in a future presentation.
For now, let's see if genetics supports the myths regarding how Nordic territories were populated by tribes that entered Europe from the south and east. The earliest influx of genes that comprised the Celts came from Iberia, in particular, the coastal regions of Spain, where DNA reveals that Spanish fishermen migrated north around 4000 BC, or 6000 years ago. These people were seafaring, had primarily brown eyes and dark or black hair, and were later subsumed into a larger Celtic tribe coming in from Eurasia and the Middle East. The genetics of these Neolithic or Stone Age inhabitants with brown eyes were passed on by mostly females as they encountered waves of blue-eyed Bronze Age men genetically closer to modern Irish penetrating into Europe from the area around the Black Sea around 4,000 years ago. This genetic shift saw an increase in farming, animal husbandry, meaning the branch of agriculture concerned with animals and livestock that are raised from meat, fiber, milk, or other products, as well as metalwork in the region, including swastika-adorned weapons, such as seen in the Viking era. The farmers that came in from the steppe of southern Russia that brought the metalworking culture and the genetic disposition for blue eyes also brought the gene for a blood disorder so often found in Ireland, and it's known as the Celtic disease, hemochromatosis. So it seems that the legends of North Africans and Scythians from the East holds true, which also supports biblical interpretations of lost tribes of Israel that long ago seem to have also been blue-eyed when they occupied the Levant, later entering and dispersing into Europe, which I covered in my last video called Magicians of the Temple. That said, ancient Celts, from which both the Irish and, by association, the Scots are descended, were known for their love of tartan, which I open this presentation with, and is the style of clothing found on the 4,000-year-old Aryan mummies found in the Tarim Basin of Central Asia. They're remarkably well-preserved, with Caucasian features, blonde and red hair, very tall and fair-skinned, with high-bridged noses and round eyes. This matches descriptions in ancient Chinese texts referring to an ancient race of what they describe as noble people of great height, with fair hair and deep-set blue eyes. They were buried with bronze swastikas and high-quality woven textiles, many of them with tartan patterns revered by the Celts. The tartan patterns also match those found in the old Hallstatt culture of Austria.
It is important through genetics to figure out where people came from, because they don't look like they belong. That is a funny way of saying it, because they were there, they lived there, and they did belong. But we have, as modern human beings, a preconceived notion about how the world should look like. Well, the mummies from China don't look like they should be in China. They look like they should be in Denmark or Ireland or northern Germany, because they look like people from over there. So what are these guys doing so many hundreds, thousands of miles to the east? DNA steps up to the plate, and they can tell us where they came from. Archaeology steps up to the plate and says when they may have come over. Combine the two, you've got the family history and the kit and caboodle that they lived in. What are these people doing there? So long ago, well before the opening of the Silk Road, which is dated to 138 BC, these mummies date back, some of them, to 2000 BC. We are, in our bodies, the carrier of an archive, a genetic archive. It tells, if you were to study me, where I'm from, and if I studied you, where you're from. And there's no lying about it. In your books, you might say you're from another place, but your genetics will tell us exactly where you're from. The female mummies were mostly of local origin. However, there's another type of testing, the Y chromosome testing, which is the male line. The males came from parts further west, not necessarily Ireland, but places like Iran, maybe towards parts of Turkey. The mom's side and the grandmother's side is from the Tarim Basin, and the father's and the grandfather's side were moving in with their sheep, with their herds, slowly but surely, and having families, living their daily lives. So that is an additional aspect that the archaeological part to some extent corroborates, but doesn't tell in that great a detail. And that's the wonderful thing about DNA testing.
So the DNA of the Aryan mummies of the Tarim Basin indicate a male lineage stemming from, quote, Iran or Turkey, which is the Caucasus Mountains, where northern Iran is located, Armenia, Turkey, Georgia, and Azerbaijan, an area near the Black Sea that the archaeologist Thor Heyerdahl claimed Odin originated from based on Icelandic sagas, an Aryan Scythian. Northern Europeans are among the highest concentration of lactose-tolerant people in the world, meaning the majority of the population can digest milk and dairy products as an adult, a genetic trait that was introduced to Europe from the East, and by the same blue-eyed people that domesticated and introduced cattle and horses to Europe. While blue eyes only makes up 6% of the world's population, the gene that causes it is the same in all blue-eyed people, no matter where they're born in the world, and genetic sequencing has revealed that all blue-eyed people of the Holocene, including recessive carriers, meaning they may not have blue eyes themselves, but they carry the gene and their children might, share ancestry from a tribe of people around the Black Sea that spread out with agricultural civilization and over 400 Aryan languages starting around 8,000 years ago. So it isn't only the domesticated animals, such as oxen and horses, that the Aryans introduced to India in the east and Europe in the west. It isn't just the Indo-European languages that the Aryans disseminated, such as Sanskrit, Farsi, Turkarian, German, French, Latin, Celtic, English, and many others. It isn't just the genetics, such as lactose tolerance and blue eyes, which are apparent in the Sumerian and Babylonian blue-eyed statues of their nobility, or the statues of pharaohs and nobility of ancient Egypt, or the depictions of the blue-eyed Buddha, an ethnic Aryan whose philosophy was spread to three-quarters of Asia. It isn't just the symbology, such as the swastika we find buried with 4,000-year-old blonde and red-headed Turkarian or Aryan mummies along the Silk Road of China. Incidentally, the same symbol the Vikings revered and etched on their artifacts, swords, and incorporated into the runes themselves. But even the myths and religions show their mark, evident in the gods and goddesses of antiquity, which all subscribe to the same astrotheology as laid out by the ancient Aryan magician priests, the Magi, whose zodiac is not only revealed in the statues of Mithras in places like Iran and Rome, but with the same archetype of a thunder god from the Indian Indra, or Babylonian Marduk, Roman Jupiter, or Greek Zeus, whose thunderbolt is symbolically identical to the mighty hammer of Thor, the god of thunder and lightning in Norse mythology, which now leads us back to Odin, the terrible one, and not just the archetype of the one-eyed deity, but before he was bestowed with symbolic occult attributes, was there really a man before the myths and legends? And if so, where did he come from? Archaeologist and historian Thor Heyerdahl of Kon-Tiki fame has garnered considerable evidence to support the theory concerning ancient migrations into Scandinavia from the region generally known as the Caucasus and steppes. Heyerdahl speculated that Odin, commonly thought of today as a mythical Norse god, was a historical person who founded the Norwegian-Swedish royal dynasty. Heyerdahl first began forming his hypothesis after visiting the petroglyphs of Gobastan, an ancient cave dwelling found 30 miles west of Baku, capital of Azerbaijan, which is famous for its rock carvings, some of which date back at least 5,000 years. The sketches of sickle-shaped boats carved into these rocks closely resemble rock carvings found in his own native Norway. Determined to prove that early man could have crossed the ocean in reed boats, Thor Heyerdahl sailed a reed boat 3,270 sea miles in 57 days in 1970. Years later, he stumbled upon correlations between Scandinavia and the Caucasus, noting that Norwegian mythology tells that the Nordic god Odin moved with his people to Norway from a land called Asser, whose description matches the Scythian region east of the Caucasus Mountains and the Black Sea. Is this story mythology, or could it have been based, at least in part, on actual history? Scythian is one of the names of the Aryans that lived all across the steppes, which is the name of a large area of flat, unforested grassland stretching from Mongolia and Russia to southeastern Europe, all the way into parts of Hungary. Incidentally, Hungary gets its name from the Huns, another tribe that entered Europe from Central Asia and the Caucasus, who conquered the Alans and various other Scythian tribes, which are all names for ancient Aryans, which entered Europe in several waves from east to west. A large part of European history involves migrations from the east, such as Catalonia, which derives its names from Goth Alania, land of the Goths and Alans, which were Aryans, an Rh-negative dense population in present-day Barcelona, Spain, or the Celts, which according to Irish annals descend from the Scythians, who allegedly descend from Magog, the son of Japheth, a son of Noah, whose ark settled on Ararat, a mountain in the Caucasus. Both biblical history and pagan mythology seem to be supported by the archaeological and genetic evidence, even if it's downplayed in the media. The Search for Odin is the project title of Thor Heyerdahl's last series of archaeological excavations, which took place in Russia. His intention was to prove the validity of Icelandic sagas written in the 13th century about the Norse royal dynasties and the pre-Christian Norse gods. Written in Old Norse by the Icelandic poet and historian Snorri Sturluson, the original legends date back several centuries earlier and concern the history of the Norwegian kings from a mythical prehistoric age where the kings of Norway descend from this royal house of Sweden. In the initial stanzas of the poem, Asgarth is the capital of Asaland, a section of Asia east of the Don River flowing into the Black Sea. Odin is the chief of Asgard. From there he conducts and dispatches military expeditions to all parts of the world, never losing a battle. As the story goes, Odin led a section of the Æsir to the north looking for new lands on which to settle, up the Don River to Saxland, which is Germany, and then to Scandinavia. Large portions of the saga are clearly mythical, as Odin is a sorcerer, speaks only in verse, has a ship that can be rolled up like a tablecloth when not used, and relies on two talking ravens to gather intelligence. That said, findings published this week in the journal Nature reported data from a genetic study of 442 Viking remains from a burial site dating between 2400 BC and 1600 AD, which resulted in headlines such as, quote, "New Viking DNA testing shows nearly all of them were part Asian." Of course, when we're talking about over 4,000 years ago, Asian takes on a completely different context, as there were blonde and red-headed Chinese mummies that predate the arrival of modern East Asian phenotypes by over 1,000 years. Asian, in this context, means Aryan, or bearded Caucasoid, rather than Mongoloid, who, to a large degree, lack facial hair. My apology for using an outdated term, but I want to be clear to my subscribers, as this distinction is not properly explained in most of the mainstream articles. In a statement, Esk Willerslev, the lead author and director of the Lundbeck Foundation Geogenetic Center at the University of Copenhagen, said, quote, "This study changes the perception of who a Viking actually was. No one could have predicted these significant gene flows into Scandinavia from Southern Europe and Asia happened before and during the Viking Age." I think it's safe to say that Dr. Willerslev has never heard of Thor Heyerdahl and seems oblivious to any archaeological conclusions held from before World War II. Do these genetic findings conclusively prove that Odin was a flesh and blood chieftain that led a mass migration into Scandinavia? No, not directly. But in the context of this DNA study, I'd like to read a brief passage from the Encyclopedia Britannica, 9th edition, volume 2, page 594, under the topic Asgard. Quote, The historical explanation of Asgard, as given by the early northern authorities, is that in the country called Asaheim, to the east of Tanagvis, the Tanis or the Dawn, in Asia, there was a city, Asgard, in which ruled a great chief known as Odin or Woden, who presided over religious sacrifices which were held there. He and other Sarmatians or Caucasian chiefs left their settlement on the Black Sea and wandered forth in search of new and independent homes to the north and west to the primary Asiatic seat of their tribes. Odin, foreknowing that he and his posterity would occupy the northern lands, left Asaheim with a vast multitude of followers and wandered first westward to Garderich, which is Russia, and afterwards to Saxland, north and east Germany. After some time, he proceeded northward, till at length he came to Mälar Lake in Sweden, where they settled at a place known as Sigtuna, the present Uppsala. His 12 dyer, or chief priests, in the course of time founded states for themselves, and everywhere set up the laws and usages which they had followed in Asaheim. Here we have a historical link with the mythic story of Odin's halls in Asgard and his 12 attendants, Æsir. It is not improbable that the traditionary records of such earlier migrations had lingered among the people dwelling on the shores of the Euxine, for it is certain that, whatever may be the age of Odin's appearance in Scandinavia, previous waves of population had passed from the Black Sea to the Baltic and cleared the way for the reception of that highest phase of Aryan civilization brought to Northern Europe by Odin and his followers. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you would like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those who are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and don't forget to subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.